Hello, I'm a Mac.
PC Choice Chat.
PC Choice Chat.
Yes, a radio show that helps people pick the best PCs for them. Hey, let's go to the phones. Tom from Kalamazoo, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? What PC do you recommend for people who hate getting viruses?
Oh, that's a good question.
Crank call. Let's go to Wendy from Fairfield. Hello.
What PC offers great customer support like Mac Genius?
No, not doing that one. Let's go to Greg from Dearborn, Michigan. You're on the air.
I'm a longtime PC user. Now I'm thinking about switching to Mac.
I love doing that.
Hello, and welcome to the Holecast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Irfan Elijah. Join me today. He's the chief of Cult of Mac, and I'm hoping his next book will be titled, I Made It, Yo! Documenting Tim Cook's humble beginning and rise to global domination. That's a bestseller right there, Leander Katie.
Funny you should mention that.
Oh, really?
I just got a book deal right now to write a book about Tim Cook.
You're kidding.
No. Did you hear the clacking away on the keyboard?
I am Nostradamus sitting here in this chair. That is too funny. Okay, hold on. Also joining us, recently residing in Thailand, the sex appeal of his beard sent local men scrambling to compete, sending sales of costume beards soaring to unsustainable levels. Buster, the sexy man, Heine is here.
Hey, what's up?
Is that the hot new look in Penang right now?
I haven't even had a beard like all year. Actually,
what?
So
wait
yeah.
a second. What?
Sorry.
But every picture I've seen of you, you have a beard. Is that because in the morning you don't have one, but by afternoon you do?
Yeah, it's pretty gnarly.
Okay.
My 8 o'clock shadow or 5 o'clock shadow is like 3 inches.
It's like a 4-year growth for most men. That makes me very sad. What? Why are you trying to chop off the gift that God has given you?
Yeah, I just wanted a fresh look for 2017,
so
man.
So fresh. Really?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The bearded look is so fresh. There is no fresher look than that.
I don't know, man. Like, yeah, sometimes you just got to mix it up.
I mean, is it hard, though, like when you have the beard and everywhere you go, it's like there's like women pinching your tush and winking at you, and you're like, come on.
Yeah.
My eyes are up here.
I had to, exactly why.
They're constantly just
it.
Looking at your beard cleavage.
Yeah. I'm just like, damn, I need to get my hands all in that.
Oh, I second that emotion, my friend. Well, hey, before I forget, if you guys want to catch a glimpse of Buster's beautiful beard growth, we are doing a live show. It's going to be Monday, October 2nd at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And I will have a link in the show notes to my YouTube channel where it will be broadcast. We're going to be broadcasting it live on YouTube. But if you want to just type it in right now and subscribe so you don't miss it, it's youtube.com/ Irfan Elijah, Erfonelijah. And there'll be a link in the show notes as well. And we're just gonna have a raucous good time. Leander Caney's gonna be there. Buster is gonna be there with a full beard. And we'll be answering your questions. You could see the Cult of Mac worldwide global headquarters where
should I do a tour again?
Absolutely. I want to see that book that you used to prop up your couch again too. This one will be titled Tim Cook. That will be on a future broadcast. Last time we had so many laughs that my six pack was sore for days. And so it's an event that you're not going to want to miss. So again, I'll put the link in the show notes if you want to check that out. That live show out will be Monday, October 2nd at 12 p.m. Here's what we've got for you this show. We're going to be talking about the triumph of Face ID. Apple released a white paper about the technology that goes into this week, which I found to be very interesting. And there was a data scientist who wrote a paper about why Face ID is so exciting. And I was reading through this, and per usual, Apple will release a feature that most people just don't think very much about. And then when you start reading about how complicated it is and how much research and development went into it, it's kind of mind-blowing. As you probably know, Mac OS High Sierra is also out now, and we'll be talking about that and its notable new features. I haven't installed yet because, unlike Leander Caney, I never install new software on critical systems right before we go to recording. And Leander did it the moment it came out, and Buster did too this time. And so we'll be talking about that, and then we're going to be wrapping up with an all-new under review where I have a absolutely huge, huge pick this week. It's a product that is not only a very large, one of the largest products that I've ever talked about on the show, but probably one of the coolest products as well. And I'm excited to talk about that. And Leander, Buster, you guys both have products to talk about, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
sure. Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. All right. Well, before we dive into this week's best Apple stories, let me go ahead and say thank you to Audible for supporting this episode. Audible makes getting more books in your life so very easy. They have an unbeatable selection of audiobooks with incredible performances, and they will transform your commute into an adventure. Audible's content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and business information providers. And unlike a streaming or rental service, the Audible books that you get are yours. You own them, and you can access them anytime, anywhere from almost any device, including your iPhone, iPad, Android device, which I know no one listening to this show actually has ever touched an Android device, Amazon Fire tablets, or even looked at one, or Windows phone. Yes, even the Windows phone can handle an audiobook. Audible makes getting books into your life easy. And let me go ahead and recommend to you probably the best book in all of Audible. Wouldn't you agree, Leander?
Oh, yeah.
Jony Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products. Leander Caney's award-winning, Emmy-winning, Oscar-winning book. That has received piles of accolades. Leander, what is the book about?
The career of Apple celebrated designer Jony Ive. It traces his childhood, education, and career at Apple through told through the products. It is by far the best book written about him, and probably the only one.
There's got to be other Jony Ive books out there, but yours is certainly
the
most.
Actually, I'm not sure really? There is. This is his own book. You know, he did his own Apple coffee table book, but it's got no words in it, not one.
You mean the product book?
Yeah.
that hardly qualifies as,
I don't think there's anything else out there. The only thing I know of is there was a New Yorker profile at 14,000 words.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, half a book, maybe a quarter of a book. But wow. I don't think there's any other books. I haven't seen one anyway.
You know why that is, Leander? Because once people saw that book, your book, they said, why even try? This is the best this book is ever going to be. Let's retire this category forever. There is no reason to even attempt to write another book. Let's just move on. Maybe let's write a book about Steve Ballmer.
Yeah, right.
when's this new Tim Cook book going
to
be out?
Yeah. But,
well, right. I don't know. I just mentioned it briefly to my publisher like a week ago, and now I'm already involved in doing it, so I don't know what I was thinking. In fact it was after the podcast, when we were talking about the amazing operation that he's helped build at Apple, and I was thinking, there's definitely a book there, I think, in about how this operates, about how Apple operates and its manufacturing operates, and how Tim Cook helped Steve Jobs bring Apple back from the brink of death, and they built this amazing machine. And one of the things that sold them was like how much bigger Apple is now than when Steve Jobs died. Mm-hmm. The stock is worth three times as much. The market capitalization is three times as big. Really? There's just so much bigger.
iPhones. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I know you were probably going to ask me this anyway, and I just want to put this out there now. You don't need to be bashful. If you want me to write the foreword for you, I will do that. Okay?
All right. Okay.
I'll even let you put my picture next to yours in the jacket.
Arms around each other, yeah. I couldn't have done it without you.
In fact, if you want to just write co-authors Leander Caney, Irfan Elijah, that would be fine with me too. And we'll take I'll fly out there. We'll take a great picture for the jacket. I'll wear my leather jacket with tweed elbow covers that I made myself.
And we'll get a cult cloth in there somehow, right?
every book comes with a free cult cloth. This product offering just keeps getting better and better. But let me finish talking about Audible. So if you want to experience the power of Leander Caney's Jony Ive book, which I recommend, I say this honestly, Leander is a fantastic writer. And he writes the way that he talks, so his books are really easy to read.
Gibberish?
Yeah, exactly.
Stuttering?
Totally incomprehensible and making you think that he has had 5 to 6 beers, which is probably the case. I highly recommend the Jony Ive book, and you can get it free. You can get a free audiobook with a trial to audible.com/cultcast. You get a free audiobook of your choice. And I recommend the Johnny Ive book, of course, but you can choose from many.
They did a good job recording it. They got a professional, recording artist down in LA.
They didn't ask you to do it?
Well, no. I think they might have done. I can't remember. I definitely declined. Like, I didn't want to. It was bad enough writing it, let alone reading the damn thing.
It's hard. It's hard to read without making, oral mistakes. And reading a book that long, that you really have to, A, be a professional, and B, not be drunk to get that.
Right. They got a really good guy to do it. He's done a bunch of audiobooks. He has a really good voice.
He's got a great voice. Really nice. Man, what a job that guy has. All he does is read books for a living and probably makes like six figures. That's audible.com/cultcast, and you can get a free audiobook of your choice. Again, Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products. Did I get that right? Every time I say it, it sounds
wrong.
That's
it. That's exactly it.
Okay. All right. Let's move on. I wanted to start with a couple really lighthearted stories that I found to be entertaining. The first one, Bill Gates has ditched his Windows mobile phone. Buster, did you write this story?
No, I did not.
Was this Killian?
I think it was, and I LOL'd at it.
Dude, I lolled pretty hard at this too. So apparently Bill Gates has moved on from the Windows phone. Is Windows phone even a thing anymore? I thought they retired all of them.
I think they're still trying. They're still trying with Windows 10, I think.
They're trying to push the Nokia phones? Oh my gosh. Yeah. That was completely unintentional. I said that because that's the way Steve Bomdog Ballmer says it. He calls it Nokia.
We're very excited to bring the best mobile device efforts of Microsoft and Nokia together.
And it has crept into my psyche, and now I say Nokia, even though before I said Nokia. That just shows what a powerful influence he has over me. So you probably are asking yourself, what phone is Bill Gates using now? Well, alas, it is not iOS. He has switched to Android. He didn't say which Android phone that he is using. But what I found to be interesting is he's still so adamant against iOS. He doesn't want to use it. And he even had a lifelong relationship with Steve Jobs, and still, nothing. He just, when they asked him about the possibility of switching to iOS instead, he said, nope, no iPhone. I wonder if he still doesn't allow iPads into his house.
Probably not. It's funny, like, you're done with Microsoft. Just f***ing embrace iOS, man.
Just move on, dude.
Take
some
LSD,
at least try it.
Enjoy life.
Yeah, that's right.
What Steve Jobs would say.
Such a bitter rivalry,
It is kind of petty, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, especially it's just strange.
Microsoft got started like as a Macintosh developer. That was really one of their big early successes was developing for the Mac. They had more people working on the Mac than or as many people as Apple did at one time.
They had all sorts of Apple software that they made money on back then. I mean, they still do today.
Yeah.
And especially today, I feel like Microsoft is more agnostic than ever. They just want to put software everywhere. They don't care what device it goes on. If you have a popular device, they want you to buy Office.
Well, that's under the new leadership, isn't it? Yeah, they're much more realistic. But Gates was always like that, though, wasn't he? Stuff were exclusive for Windows only, Microsoft only.
It just goes to show that clearly he has been affected by the Apple-Windows rivalry and probably some of the things that Steve Jobs said. I mean, Steve Jobs was pretty incendiary in some of his insults. against Windows. And Bill Gates seems like a pretty subdued, easygoing guy, but clearly he was wounded.
Oh, there's no way. He's not easygoing at all. He's really competitive, fiercely competitive.
But he doesn't seem like he would hold a grudge for something that Steve Jobs said 20 years ago. Does he to you?
Well, when they appeared on the WSJ digits together,
yeah,
they seemed to be there was definitely a chemistry there, and they were definitely had both mellowed since the early days, and they were joking around, and they seemed quite amiable. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine Gates harboring a grudge, a lifelong
clearly,
grudge.
Clearly, I think he is.
Yeah, you can't make your company like the biggest company in the world without being like a super competitive person that wants to crush everybody, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like Bono once said, you don't end up in front of 70,000 people on accident. Okay, well, onwards from there, the Apple TV looks like it's on the verge of finally getting the Amazon Video app. I don't know. I don't understand all the complexities of the Amazon Apple relationship, but a while back there was a huge explosion, and Amazon and Apple decided to stop working together. It seemed like in any regard, and Amazon even pulled all of the Apple TVs off of Amazon. And this week we saw a listing for the Apple TV 4K, right, Buster?
Oh, indeed. Only momentarily, though.
It's gone now.
Yeah, it already got pulled like the same day it went up. Which I'm guessing is because Apple doesn't have any supply of the 64 gigabyte Apple TV 4K itself. So it's like, I think it's 3 to 4 weeks shipping time. But it looks like Amazon is going to start selling it again. Probably because Amazon's Prime Video app is finally coming to Apple TV. So.
Yeah, I know. We've got this. We're talking about this backwards. Like, who cares if Amazon is selling the Apple TV? What I care about is like the Amazon app coming to the Apple TV platform.
But that's my point. I mean, if Amazon's going to be carrying the Apple TV, this looks like they finally resolved all their issues. Things are going to get back to normal, and we'll get the Amazon Video app finally. Because if they're selling the Apple TV on Amazon, there's no way they're not going to have the app on the Apple TV. There's no way. Those two things are going to happen at the same time. And now that the Apple TV supports 4K content, and Amazon has so much 4K content to push, it just seems like the timing is right for this to actually happen. But I mean, at what point are they actually going to release this thing? They haven't even talked about when this is going to actually come out. Have you guys heard anything?
They said it was supposed to come out by this summer, I thought, Tim Cook said at WWDC, and then they're saying later this fall. So
okay.
Any time now.
I thought it was going to be when they revealed the new iPhone and the new Apple TV.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And that's probably what they were planning on, but clearly something has changed.
Engineering stuff that's holding it back or what? Yeah. You wouldn't think it'd be that complicated, though, because Apple has like whole teams that help companies get their stuff ready for Apple TV.
Okay, well, hopefully the app will be out soon, because it just sucks not having the Amazon Video app on Apple TV. That's how I consume all my media now.
Really? What do you watch on there?
My Apple TV. Well, primarily it's my interface to my Plex server.
Oh, well, I meant, do you use Amazon Prime Video a lot? Because I never use it personally.
No,
so
I don't
really care.
But the reason I don't use it is because it's not available on my Apple TV, and I don't have an easy way to watch it. Like, I could plug in the Amazon Fire Stick, but then I got to go grab a different remote, and I got to switch inputs on my television, and I have no HDMI ports to spare, so I might have to even unplug something on the back of my TV. Which, by the way, why are there only 4 HDMI inputs on most TVs? Some TVs have 3. That is preposterous.
Some have 2, and the really cheap ones have 1.
That
I
is
think.
Ridiculous. Who's designing these TVs? Have they ever actually used one? I mean, I have like I have every video game console. I have a TiVo. I have a media PC. Dude, am I the only guy that has a lot of things to plug into the HDMI? Am I just a power user?
You are. I mean, I don't have a TV right now, but all I had was Apple TV hooked up to the HDMI port.
Leander, what do you got in your TV?
Just a cable box and an Apple TV.
What about like a
Blu-ray? Oh, and a PlayStation, which we never use.
And what about
a
Blu-ray?
After I bought the VR helmet for the kids, the ungrateful little thing.
It would be a good prop for Halloween, though. They could wear it around and pretend they're in Tron.
Yeah, dust it off.
A $300 prop helmet.
But then the TV's got smart. It's a smart TV, so it's got like Netflix and Amazon built in.
Right.
And we use that fairly frequently.
Oh, well, that's a good point. My TV is really old, and so it doesn't have any apps or anything like that. So
you got to upgrade. Like, you can get a 4K TV now, a really beautiful one for like $500.
Yeah. You know what I'm waiting for, though, are those LG 60. I'm waiting specifically for one TV. It's the LG 65-inch OLED TV to come down in price, because once you've seen the image on that thing, I just don't think I can go in a different direction.
You were looking at a Best Buy or something, right?
I've seen it at Best Buy, yeah.
Where they have this kind of really hallucinated, really super detailed image.
Yeah.
And then in reality, when you get home and you watch TV, it kind of disappears. You know, you don't really realize how good an image you're looking at if you are indeed looking at a great image.
Well, no,
because all the different sources, you know, I was playing around, with the 4K stuff, and I honestly can't tell the difference between 4K and 1080p.
Oh, what?
I can, yeah. Leander. I probably from 100 Way. Paces, I could have my back turned around and I'd whip around and I'd be like 4K. HD, SD, I can tell you in a heartbeat.
Well, SD you can tell, but a good HD picture,
the jump from 1080 to 4K is bigger than SD to HD, right?
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know, practice, like watching a video, I really couldn't tell.
Well, I think if you were watching a Blu-ray, an HD Blu-ray, and you switched to a compressed 4K signal, I think you actually might be right. In fact, the Blu-ray might even look better. But if you have a 4K signal versus a digital signal versus a 4K HD signal, I think I could tell.
Maybe I wasn't making the right comparisons, but I have to I'll try queuing. If I queued something up on Netflix on 4K, and then try to switch the resolution on the TV, that would be a fair test, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, I'll give it a try.
Give that a shot. And the other thing too is it's an interesting point. Is a lot of sources just aren't in 4K, and that's one of the reasons why I haven't wanted to buy a 4K television, because you're just watching HD content in 4K, and I thought I was going to do what you just recommended, Leander, that is get a cheaper 4K television. And there was another brand I was looking at, and it's one of the better 4K LED televisions that are out there. And the 4K image looked great, and then I saw some image of it in HD. They were showing some HD content, and it looked like shite. I was like, why would you want to subject yourself to big, grainy pixels like this? You might as well just stick with an HD television, which looks sharp when you are watching HD content, because a lot of the 4K televisions will upscale. Well, they'll pretty much all upscale the HD signal, but they don't all have the same skill at doing that, and the LG OLED TVs are very good at upscaling the picture, so you kind of get good picture no matter what content you're watching. But of course, you have to pay big bucks for an LG TV. The one I was looking at, I think, is 20... If you get a good price on it, you can get it for $2,300, which these days for a TV is crazy. Mm-hmm, I mean, most TVs are under $1,000. Anyway, I digress. So hopefully we'll have Amazon Video 4K content soon on our Apple TVs, because that means I'll actually get to use the service that I'm paying for. Let's move on to Face ID. Apple released a white paper about the technology behind it, which I'll link to in the show notes. And if you're interested in how the technology works and when you'll have to authenticate versus when you'll have to enter in your passcode, I think you'll really enjoy it. And it's not super long either. It's only like 4 or 5 pages, and you could probably just skim it for a lot of the information. But it got me thinking more about Face ID and the incredible technology that is Face ID. And I was reading this piece by this data scientist named Abdul Jamali, who works in development of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and big data. He works at a company called AnPlus. And he also, I think, does social media stuff. And I'm wondering if he just put out this article to pimp his company, which if he did, it's definitely doing that, because here we are talking about it. But he was talking about how amazing Face ID was, and for various reasons. But first, I'm just curious, Leander or Buster, did you guys read that or any parts of that white paper?
No.
You didn't check it out? I mean, it sounds terribly boring, doesn't it?
Yeah, I tried to at one point, and I was like, I'm not going to comprehend this.
You should read it at night before you go to bed, if you have insomnia especially. I actually just want to say it's a lot more interesting than it sounds, because normally when I hear white papers, I'm like, not even going to try and read that, because white papers are totally boring. But this one actually was written in an interesting way. So let me just highlight some of the pieces that this researcher brought up about Face ID and why it's such an incredible accomplishment on Apple's part. He says that, I've gone on and on about the difficulty of building machine learning tech. There simply isn't enough computational power or data to go around, because AI takes such a huge amount of computing power. He goes on to say, the A11 Bionic CPU in the new generation of phones is borderline unrealistic. And Apple went a step further and included an onboard neural engine for all artificial intelligence processing. With fast CPU performance, GPU performance, and now onboard neural engines, you'd think that the battery would deplete in moments of authentication. But somehow, Apple not only maintained better consumption from normal use with Touch ID, but increased battery life by 2 hours Besides computational power, the biggest drawback in building this type of technology is the amount of data to go around to train the neural network. And the pieces that I took away from this that I was really impressed by was big data applications like this usually take a huge amount of computational power, and they also, by the nature of taking a lot of computational power, take a lot of electricity, right? And Apple was somehow able to make this technology available to you on a mobile device for the first time, which is going to dramatically increase its usefulness, I think. But even while including this incredibly powerful technology in the power of your hand for the first time ever, they were able to do it while still increasing your battery life. And that was the part that really blew this researcher's mind, is normally this type of technology would zap your battery and make your phone have terrible battery life, but Apple still was able to provide you with excellent battery life, even with this new technology built in. Aside from the computational power and battery life, the other part that blew this guy's mind was training AI takes a unimaginable, huge, massive set of data for the AI to begin to be able to teach itself how it's going to behave. And he was talking about how this software needs to be able to tell the intricacies, the different facets of, I think, how many different kinds of faces are out there, right? All the different types of eyes, all the different types of ears and eyebrows and eyelashes and all that stuff. The AI had to be able to recognize all those things, tell how those things could change, adapt to those changes to maintain the high level of security iOS users expect from their devices. And not just anyone has access to these types of massive data sets. In fact, very few companies do. It takes a company like Apple to generate the data sets that are needed to train AI in this fashion. And he was geeking out. And because he was geeking out, I started to geek out over this accomplishment that Apple was able to take, what they said, like a billion photos of a billion different faces, and analyze those faces and use those faces to train their software to identify all the little intricacies of what makes your face unique and how your face can change. When you start reading it from that perspective, at that level of wonder of someone who's involved in the industry and is really amazed and wowed by what Apple has accomplished, it really gave me a new respect for the accomplishment here. And this is not just another feature that Apple can drop and I'm going to forget about. Every time I use it, I think I'm going to have that in my mind, that Apple really has created something magical here. And we're just at the beginning. That's the other thing too. We're just at the beginning of this. AI is starting to proliferate in all these different areas, and Apple especially is starting to use it in all these different aspects of their technology. And now you have a neural engine. Like, think of like the brain. Remember Terminator 2? They have to go into the factory and they have to steal the brain of the Terminator that's in there. Spoiler alert. That is what you have inside your iPhone now. You have this insane level of AI, this computational power that hasn't existed before, now just resting in your iPhone 10. It boggles. It boggles the imagination.
Oh, man. Besides, it's cool. So amazing. So glad they do that shit.
It is. I think the more you know about it, the more incredible it is, for sure. You know, I think it does blow the geeks' minds what they're able to do on the handset itself. You know, thanks to the bionic chip and the neural engine.
Right.
It is pretty astonishing. And like you said, the training sets, I found it impressive that it continues to train itself on your face. So if you lose weight, gain weight, grow a beard, change your hairstyle, you know, it still recognizes you. So it's still doing a lot of ongoing training.
It also, it brings AI to an accessible level. I mean, it's like ARKit, right? This kind of esoteric thing that people had kind of played around with, but most people had never experienced. Now it exists on your mobile device, and developers can build off the platform that Apple has provided them. So it is going to become much more ubiquitous and affect our lives in ways that we haven't even imagined at this point, because Apple was able to take something that was incredibly complex and make it accessible to everybody. And yeah, the more you learn about it, I couldn't agree more. The more you learn about Face ID and the AI that Apple is using and all these various processes now throughout their company, the more it kind of just blows my mind, because these things are at the very beginning of their lifespans, and where are we going to go from here? How are these things going to affect us in 10 years? Is really the part that gets me excited. Buster's beard is thoroughly wet now, I'm sure.
Dude, so moist.
Well,
you can just hear kind of the enthusiasm.
I can hear the dripping of the beard too.
Oh, it's, yeah.
It's very moist right now. Well, I'll stop droning on about that. Let's move on to Mac OS High Sierra and talk about some of the notable features that are included in the new OS. I haven't upgraded yet, like I said, because I heard it was kind of buggy. But have you guys been having any problems with it?
None.
Not a single one?
I feel like today's Coldcast, like I don't know. I feel like it's my computer, not my internet connection, that is kind of.
Yeah, you have been having issues.
So, I don't know. I'm not saying it's High Sierra, but maybe it is.
That's why I never install a new OS.
I really shouldn't have. But I downloaded it, and then it was just like taking up space on my computer. So I was like, I got to get rid of this file. Might as well install it.
Precious space, right?
I only have like 256 gigs on this Mac. So
oh man, I don't even know how you do that, quite honestly.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah.
I've got 512, but I've started doing more video editing now, and I was editing a video and I was looking at how much space it was taking up, and I'm recording it in ProRes. Uh-huh. And it's taking up like 100 gigabytes of space.
Oh,
for
yeah,
like a 7-minute video.
Yeah, that's why I did it, because I started working on a new video yesterday and started like rendering all the files, and they just take up such a huge chunk of the hard
right?
drives. So I mean, I'm like, oh shit.
I get out of here. If you're doing video, RIP your hard drive. There's just no way to do that without constantly moving the files off to like an external drive, which is what I've been doing. And I was actually thinking about buying a refurbished MacBook Pro with 1 terabyte of space just so I could have more space. I don't even care about the CPU or any of the other improvements in the newer models. I just wanted a bigger SSD. But I calmed myself down. I was like, dude, they're going to be releasing that new MacBook Pro in the next, like what, 7 to 9 months probably?
Yeah.
with the powerful Cannon Lake processor. And so I'm making myself wait for that, because it'd be a bad move to buy a new MacBook Pro right now, I think. Okay, so let's talk about some of the features of Mac OS High Sierra. If you have this installed, this is some of the goodness that you're going to be getting. I think the biggest thing, the biggest change that you probably won't even notice, but people have been talking about because it's exciting the IT nerds very much. Their beards have all been very moist about this. That Mac OS High Sierra brings the new Apple file system to the Mac. It's the first file system change in, what, 30 years? And it's supposed to be more secure. It has a 64-bit architecture. It has built-in encryption. It has crash protection and simplified data backups. I wonder if that means that the Time Machine backups will be more simple or faster in any way. I'll have to test that out. And one of the biggest improvements in the new OS is Safari, which is Apple's claiming is now the world's fastest browser with an 80% speed improvement over Google Chrome, which I'll also add, if you're not using Safari, your battery life is taking a major hit. Chrome just zaps your battery so bad. It was so bad for me that I ended up not using it, and I'm now back on Safari. And we'll talk a little bit more about some controversial features of the new Safari in just a minute, but Mail received some improvements like search functions tied to Spotlight. You can also use a new split view mode that lets you write emails while keeping tabs on your inbox. The photo apps got some big updates. There's now better facial recognition and some new editing tools that make it more capable for editing your photos. It got a new pin feature to keep your most important notes. Oh, the Notes app got a new pin feature, I should say, to keep your most important notes at the top of the list where you'll be able to find them.
Completely worthless.
Didn't work for you? Didn't like
well,
it?
Well, I don't know. You know, like notes, I use notes a lot, but I always search. You know, I don't see any point in organizing it, to be honest.
Yeah, I always use the search as well. I just, you know, type in a few words and boom, there comes the note, because I never remember where anything goes. But I'm going to give this a shot. This might be useful, because I feel like keeping notes organized is actually something that is not easy to do, and I'm always losing my notes. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention about Safari. This is pretty cool. So now Safari has the ability to auto-pause videos that automatically start playing in the background. Don't you hate those? Man, I hate those videos. And Safari should have the ability to pause those, and it's smart in the way it works, too. Like, it won't auto-pause videos that auto-play on websites like Netflix or YouTube or Hulu, you know, websites where you actually want the videos to play in the background. This is a setting, I think, you actually have to go into the Safari settings and turn this on. I don't think it works by default. And then, of course, the more controversial feature, depending on who you ask, who you talk to, is Safari's new ability to prohibit advertisers from tracking you on the web. Now, that might sound like a good thing, and I think for the most part it is, but there are also some downsides. It makes you more secure and more private because websites could previously piece together your browsing history and from your cookies and show in a picture of all the things that you've been looking at, which in Leander's case is a very bad deal. You don't want to, he definitely doesn't want people to know the websites he's visiting. But now they're not able to do that. But also there is the aspect of websites making money from ads, and a lot of the websites you love make money from ads. And if they can't make money from ads, how do they continue to exist? And Leander, this is where I thought it'd be interesting to get your perspective, because you know, Cult of Mac makes money from ads, and when there's an ad blocker in place, you know, Cult of Mac can't generate any ads and then generates less revenue. I mean, how do websites exist in this new ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. You know, we're seeing about 30% of our traffic to Cult of Mac is using an ad blocker, and which is a really significant chunk. It's a big part of the audience. You know, of course, advertising rates are going down The CPMs have been declining, and have been in decline for years. I think they've sort of balanced out now a little bit, but they're a fraction of what they used to be. You know, I mean, when I first started, I remember thinking when we got to 1 million page views, it was like, okay, we're done, we're set, that's it, we don't have to do any more. You know, that's it, that's all we need.
you're gonna get on a boat and sail off into the sunset. You're gonna retire.
And now, you know, 10 million page views isn't enough. It's an industry that is very much under pressure from Facebook a lot and Google. You know, this is where most of the money goes in the advertising business. The online advertising business goes to either Facebook or Google. And so, you know, advertising companies and publishers have taken, you know, ever more drastic measures to try to maintain their revenues. You know, we're lucky in that we're such a small outfit that we don't have, you know, like huge newsrooms, huge operations to maintain. So I feel really bad for some of the bigger publishers. You know, like the local newspaper industry is really being decimated by its move from print to digital, and the fact that there's not a really good digital revenue stream for these publications. You know, the other thing, you know, I mean, we've done all sorts of things. Like, one is diversifying, you know, our revenue stream. So it's not just advertising. We're also trying to get e-commerce revenue, and we've been fairly successful at doing that with our daily deals. That's always been a very successful part of the Cult of Mac mix. And now the watch store, you know, we're trying to sell goods more directly, to get back to the point, we use tracking. We turn on tracking for Cult of Mac. So if anyone comes to the Cult of Mac site, a store, and starts looking at some of our the stuff we're selling there, we had a retargeting campaign running on Google for a little while. So they would see, they would happen, you know, they would get those ads, those horrible ads, you know, they'd be looking at a band, and then suddenly they'd see a Cult of Mac ad, you know, when they're on a completely different site, reminding them that they might have been interested in this. And I hate to say it, but it's an effective form of advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, like the customers that the people that you're most likely to get to spend money on the site to buy something are the ones that have already been looking. You know, and maybe they were checking a couple of things out, and they want to go check out some prices somewhere else, and they forgot about it, and then it gives them a reminder, you know, to come back and finish that purchase. It's unfortunately it's an effective advertising strategy. People find it very creepy, obviously, for obvious reasons. You're being tracked, and you're being tracked all over the web. And I think it has got to the point where there's, you know, obviously there's a big consumer backlash against it. You know, personally, when you understand how it works, and the I don't think the reasons are that nefarious, given all the other kind of tracking that goes on online. especially governmental tracking, you know, and the kind of stuff that, you know, the NSA is sweeping up about our communications. You know, I think that's a far more serious issue. I don't have a big moral objection to, you know, commercial tracking. I find the stuff that Facebook does is far more disturbing. You know,
like I do too. I find it downright creepy. In fact, it's made me apprehensive to use Facebook.
Right. Well, because Facebook really is a gigantic, you know, spying machine set up for commerce. I don't like Facebook at all. I can understand how people think it's creepy. And I definitely think, you know, the trouble is that it's very difficult for this industry to regulate itself, you know? The boundaries are always getting pushed. It seems, you know, what seems reasonable to us, and for me as a publisher and as someone who's running an e-commerce operation, you know, I don't think what we're doing to people who visit the site, I don't think we're violating their privacy. I really don't, you know, and we definitely benefit from it. I'm a little concerned. I'm concerned about the larger ecosystem rather than our little part of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. I know it sounds self-serving, and I'm sure I'm not going to convince everybody about this, but it's like, you know, I think we're doing it within some ethical boundaries, and some people do it, you know, with
and some people don't
a little bit.
And I totally get what you're saying, because you know how it's being used on your end, and you're like, you know, if you are on Cult of Mac, we might show you a product that you were looking at in the deal store on a different website. You know, we track you in that way, and that's not really all that harmful and nefarious. But there are other websites that might use that information in a much more nefarious way.
This is the same thing though, but this has been going on. This has been the advertising business forever. You know, this is like mail order catalogs and, you know, sort of. It's taken to a different level, but the advertising industry and commerce has always used these kind of, has always tried to get this kind of stuff. You know, you fill out a survey, you say what you're interested in, you know, you enter into a competition to try to win something, and then you're on a mailing list. You know, it's always operated like this. The trouble is like online, it's that much more effective, and it's and it's on a huge, grand, you know, gigantic global scale. And it's super easy, for people to be tracked in this way. And I know that people really do dislike it. But, you know, for the publishing industry, for us, the publishing industry, it's like it really is bad news. All this stuff that they're putting into Safari to stop, the cross-site trafficking is bad news for Google. And it's bad news for, like, a small segment of our business.
Right.
I think, I don't know if it's going to kill the advertising industry overnight. And it doesn't stop people seeing ads. It's not like a blanket ad blocker. I find it a little bit self-serving, you know, that Apple goes to these links. I think obviously what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, from a reader's point of view, what's a good reading experience, you know? And they've done this a lot. I mean, you've had that reading button in Safari for quite a while, where you can hit it and you can strip out all the ads. And it, you know, they're thinking from the user's point of view, you know, what gives the best user experience? How can we make it easy? But on the other flip side of that, there are people like us, the publishers, you know, who have a business model that, you know, is, I will admit, not ideal, not fantastic. You know, there's no thought to our side of the equation, which is like, how do we make enough money to keep our operations going? And it, you know, it will get to a point where, you know, you have seen a lot of, you know, when we started in 2009, it was only because of Google AdSense and, you know, Google's advertising products were allowed to a whole bunch of independent publishers to flourish, you know, because all of a sudden it opened up this revenue stream. You could go on the web, and if you get a big enough audience, you could monetize it.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed TechCrunch and GigaOm and ReadWriteWeb.
I mean, the whole web.
Venture Web, yeah. A whole bunch of, you know, like, you know, The Verge, Engadget, Gizmodo, all the tech publications, they all have their roots in that era of when, you know, when Google allowed, you know, with Google AdSense, I mean, essentially what allowed independent publishing to flourish online. And that era is definitely drawing to a close. There's no way you could launch an independent publication these days. Saying that, there's a few exceptions, but, you know, it's much, much more difficult these days. It's a super hard environment to get into. But it does, you know, it still supports independent publishers. And I think, you know, like, we're looking at subscriptions, which I'm trying to get a subscription thing going. So if readers want to subscribe, you know, they get an ad-free site. We'll have a bunch of extras thrown in, including some podcast stuff, I hope, you know. But it's complicated and it's difficult. And there's no real business model for it. And I think, you know, like, if you look at people, the big publishers like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, guess how much of their audience pays for them?
I bet it's minuscule.
It's 1%.
Yeah.
1%. You know, so people are used to reading stuff online, and they complain all the time about ads and tracking, but they, you know, they go on and they read and they consume all their media for free. And unfortunately, that is the business model that supports it at the moment. There's nothing else on the horizon that, you know, that we can turn to.
That's the double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, you want to have your browsing be private and ad-free, but you also don't want to pay for anything. And so,
well, I don't want to ad-free. You know, like, I think good. Look at the magazine industry, right? You know, like magazines that do ads well, the ads are as much as part of the content as the magazine, as the editorial. Like, look at women's magazines. Women's magazines are a perfect example of that. You know, fashion magazines, Cosmopolitan, Elle, Vogue. The vast majority of that is advertising, and the advertising is beautiful. It's beautiful photography. It's beautiful. You know, there are products in there that the audience is interested in. They want to see that. That is why they buy those magazines, for the ads.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I've had listeners get in touch with me and say, I actually like the ads that you guys do on the Cultcast because it tells me about products that I actually genuinely am interested in.
Yeah.
Which is true. Sometimes you do hear from ads or about products that you would genuinely want to use, but I feel like with AdSense, that's not the way it is. It's a wide net approach. We're just going to broadcast. It's shotgun, right? We're just going to shoot a bunch of crap out there and hope something sticks.
Well, they've changed the model. You know, the thing with AdSense is that what they're doing, they don't buy publications anymore. You know, they buy audiences. And this is why tracking is so important, because they're trying to hit a certain demographic.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
So, you know, like they used to buy, you know, advertisers used to look at CultureMac and they say, oh, here's an audience of people who use Apple products. You know, I've got a new iPhone case. It makes sense to advertise on, you know, that publication. But then they would have to go to all the different, you know, Apple publications, all the tech publications, all the places where they thought their audience would be, and do individual deals. And so now they don't have to do that anymore. They go to someone like Google and they say, okay, I want to target these people with these interests. And Facebook even more so. You know, like if you like stuff on Facebook, you know, I like the iPhone, I like, you know, photography, I like, and it has a list of all your interests. And they can target that demographic very, very effectively. And it goes cross-publication. So the publication is completely irrelevant. They don't even know that they're advertising on Cult of Mac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all they're doing is they're looking for somebody with a certain browser, a certain, you know, area, a certain zip code, et cetera, et cetera. You know, a million and one different factors. So, you know, they're buying demographics across the web. So this is why we're in this sort of situation anymore, you know, now these days. I mean, I would love it if advertisers came to us and they were super targeted and they, you know, and they were offering, like, that's the ideal situation, isn't it? Where your ads reflect the interests of your audience. And I think for someone like us, you know, we could in an ideal world run really good ads that really spoke to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that with sponsored posts, with native ads. You know, this is why native ads are taken off, and we've been quite successful with native ads. And you know, we try to do a good job with native ads. We try to work with it. We work with the advertiser a lot to craft their message, you know, so that it's interesting to our audience. And you know, I would say 99 times out of 10, it is, you know, that we're getting, they're coming to us because they want to reach our audience, and the stuff that they're advertising is of interest to our audience, or a segment of our audience anyway.
Oh, definitely. I mean, all the sponsored posts that I've seen are things that people who visit Cult of Mac would probably be interested to at least know existed.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And I think it's a service, you know. Yeah. It's like, here's something you would be interested in. Yeah, ideally, it's a service. You know, saying that, it's not perfect. You know, sometimes we get stuff from agencies and they say, you know, we try to say, well, look, you know, you sure you want to run this? It reads like a really bad press release. And oh, yeah, no, that's what we've got from the client. You know, and they don't want a word changed. So, and you've got to go with their horrible headline and their horrible copy. But the good ones will say, you know, we'll adapt the message, or you know, we'll write a post for them. We have a writer in Brooklyn that does a lot of the sponsored posts, you know, and he works very carefully with them. There's a lot of going backwards and forwards, you know, to try to find out exactly, you know, do we get the message right? Do we have the good pictures? Do we have a good video? Do we have a good headline? But yeah, I think it's you know, that's you know, in an ideal world, you would have you'd get really good ads. Like, because look at the stuff we post up for Apple. You know, every time Apple posts a video, a new ad, we do a post about it. You know, people want to see that kind of advertising. It's good advertising. It's entertaining, isn't it? It's interesting. You know, in the ideal world, the advertising would be a really good fit. But, you know, we're not in that world, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation to me. Just because, I mean, all the sites that we are used to visiting on a daily basis are almost all ad sponsored in some way. And if you have an ad blocker enabled, they always want you to whitelist, you know, so that before they show you the content, or they have a little pop-up that, you know, asks you to whitelist them. And you don't want to have your privacy protected only to lose a lot of your favorite content on the web, because people need to make money in order to produce content, right? I mean, that's the way it works.
Yeah, it's really, really expensive. I mean, you know, you got to have people writing, and they all need to be paid.
Highly paid professionals. So,
exactly.
I mean, our Buster's limousine isn't going to drive itself.
Dude, I need two chauffeurs, actually.
He has them working in shifts. One rides in shotgun. He just waits for the other guy to get tired.
Well, yeah, I got to live that Johnny Ive lifestyle.
You know? The guy drives, the other guy opens Buster's door. Okay, before we move on, let me do a quick plug for cultcloth.co. Cultcloth is a product that I launched, oh man, geez, 2 years ago now, right when the Apple Watch first launched. And if you're getting a new Apple Watch, if you're getting a new iPhone, you really should check out Cult Cloth. I use them all the time. They are the best product that I have found to keep all of your technology in sparkling, clean condition. And even now when I use them, I'm surprised every single time. I mean, you will wipe the Cult Cloth across your Apple Watch, your iPhone, and nothing is left behind but sparkling glass and metal. They keep your technology in tip-top condition. Our clean cloth are perfect for wiping all the grime off your keyboard. They absolutely obliterate grime on your keyboard. And because they have longer fibers, they get between your keys and clean the area between your keys. And then our polished cloth are perfect for your iPhone. They work well for the Apple Watch and the iPad, of course, and they'll wipe off all the fingerprints. All you gotta do is just do a little breath action, and you wipe the Cult Cloth across the glass, and nothing is left behind but glass. It's really kind of amazing. And the magic is the crushed fiber that the Cult Cloth are hewn from. Every fiber goes through this special process that crushes them and breaks them apart, so they dramatically increases the surface area. And then the fibers are taken and they're woven into these incredibly dense cloths. I just kind of stumbled onto these things. I was looking for a better way to keep my technology clean. I was using like these paper Kim wipes. And I was like, there's got to be something better. So I ordered samples of cloth from all over the world. Like literally, I have boxes still of all the samples that I ordered. And I found cloth from these manufacturers that worked astoundingly well. So I thought, hey, if I like them so much, maybe other people will as well. And they do. We have tons of great testimonials, many of which I have listed on our testimonials page at cultcloth.co. I'll stop gushing now. I'll just say this. If you would like to check them out, I have a special offer going for our listeners. You can get a free 8x8 clean cloth with any order with code CULTCAST at checkout at cultcloth.co, cultcloth.co. And the code to use at checkout is CULTCAST. Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on to the last segment of the show. This is an all-new under review where we talk about the gadgets that we're currently reviewing, what we like, what we don't like. Leander, why don't you, actually, you know what, Buster, we'll go to you. You haven't said a whole lot, so let's go ahead and start with you. What's
hold
that?
On. I got to Google what the thing is. Oh, okay, can I do two in one?
I got to Google the thing first.
Actually, I got two, they're both backpacks.
Oh, nice, okay.
If that's cool.
Sure.
One is, yeah, all right, cool. The first one is, it's what I've been traveling with all around Asia. I wanted to get everything into one backpack, but the one travel bag that I have isn't like perfect for doing outdoor stuff.
Yeah.
So what I travel mainly with, like when I'm going place to place, is Tom Bin's Hero's Journey backpack.
Hero's Journey backpack.
It's kind of an expensive backpack. It's like a $400
backpack. $400
backpack? But it's super utilitarian.
Is it made of bald eagle feathers?
Yes.
Oh, well, and, then there you go.
And baby calf leather. So it's super supple to the touch. But, all right, hear me out on it. What's great about it is, it has a bunch of different use cases. Like, you can use it like a briefcase type of carrying, or as a backpack, like a hiking backpack with, like, a hip strap. You can attach that on. My favorite feature on it, though, is it has this top compartment that mm-hmm. you can zip off. And you know how a lot of airlines, they're like super strict on bag requirements now?
Yeah.
Like, no, that's too big. So what I do is I put like all my photography and drone gear in the top pouch section, and then I can zip it off like right before I come on the flight. And then so my backpack looks way smaller, and I carry all my camera gear as like the personal item, and they're super cool with it. So it's really awesome.
So is this specifically designed for air travel?
I wouldn't say it's specifically for air travel, but...
But you're just using it that way because of the zip-off top.
Yeah, I'm using it that way. I'm using it just because it's, really good, like, one bag, like, for everything. So that's why I have it.
Holy moly. By the way, this is a cool-looking bag, by the way. But I think correction, it's $480.
Okay, $480, whatever. Worth it. Totally worth it.
It's only an extra 80 bones.
Yeah, whatever.
Dude, this is a good-looking backpack.
It's not. It's kind of like looks like a dad backpack, but
yeah, dad pack does, for sure.
A lot of people you see out here like that are backpacking. They're like they have like real like legit hiking backpacks, which I think is just kind of dumb. And then they usually have a second backpack that they're wearing on the front too, like double packing it.
Oh yeah,
which I think is totally ridiculous. I can carry like everything in this thing. It has like tons of little different compartments. Use some packing cubes with it. It's the bomb.
Dude, this is made in Seattle.
Yeah. The company's really good. And they have other smaller backpacks that are cheaper if you want something different. And then the other backpack I have, which is like my favorite backpack, it's from Outdoor Research, and it's called the Dry Payload Pack. And this one's more affordable. It's only $150. And the best thing about it is it's a waterproof backpack, and you know I get everything wet and break everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like my godsend. Anytime I go out to like explore the city or anything like that, I always put everything like my camera gear in this backpack, just so it stays dry and I don't break my stuff. And it's super convenient because it rolls up really small and like fits into the other backpack.
I see these bags everywhere around here.
Oh, I bet in Seattle, yeah.
Yeah,
and you need them in a town like that where it rains a lot. So
right, and people are riding their bikes around and stuff.
Yeah. I would say my only complaint with it is it doesn't have any internal compartments or anything, so everything is just inside this big bag. So you have to organize it really well so that it doesn't feel weird on your back.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's like super useful for everything, whether it's hiking or just city stuff. And I don't know. I don't think it looks that bad. It's a roll top. So to like waterproof it, all you do is just roll the top down like 3 times and then clip it together and it's ready to go.
You put this thing on, move to Portland.
Yeah.
You'd fit right in there.
Or just get some river gauges. Yeah. I'll even take it like when we go cliff jumping, I'll just put all my drone and my camera in it. And then I just hop in the water and don't even have to worry about like keeping it above my head.
Oh, it's completely
like
waterproof.
Yeah. Completely waterproof.
Oh, wow.
Super nice.
Okay. Wow. Jeez. I wasn't expecting Buster to pimp out a $480 backpack.
Yo.
And then a $150 backpack.
Hey, that's, I travel in style, bro.
I guess. He travels in coach, but he's got first class backpacks. Yeah. Okay, well, I have a product that I've been playing around with for, I don't know, a month and a half now. I like to dabble, as many of you know, with different types of audio gear and musical equipment, too. I am a really bad guitar player, but I do enjoy playing guitar, and I like to shred every now and again. And I'm even better at air guitar, but that's a different segment. I got my hands on a new guitar amp from Fender. It's part of a series of new guitar amps they make called the Mustang series, the Fender Mustang series. And they make several of these in this line. There's an amp called the GT200, which I'm currently using. There's a GT100, which is smaller. And there's a GT40, which is the smallest of the three. And these are iOS friendly, iPhone controlled amps. And they're smart amps too. So you can use your iOS device to control all the different sounds and attributes of any one of these amps. You can whip out your iPhone and control on the fly. They have a bunch of built-in models, so you can make this one amp take on the sound signature of a whole variety of other Fender amps. They have, I think, 100 other Fender amps built into this one amp. All these different sounds, these different characters and different timbres, into this one amp, and you could just switch through them on the amp itself or on the iOS app. And there's effects pedals. There's a whole bunch of stuff built in. And so one of these amps is like buying like 1,000 different sounds for your guitar. It's incredible. You can turn on sounds that make you sound like Prince, which was one of the first things that I did, and have your guitar sound exactly like it did in Purple Rain.
What about your
Rain.
Horrible guitar playing?
Huh?
What about your
Well, it won't help you. It won't help you with that. I mean, I play like an angel, but if your guitar playing isn't up to snuff, then you're going to need to practice regardless of your guitar sound. But there's a lot of really famous sounds that are built into it, and plus they have this marketplace. Marketplace isn't really the right way to describe it. It's a place where people with the amp can build their own sounds with the amp and then publish them, and then you can download them to your amp. So I found one that made my amp sound like Slash, and I was like, dude, now I'm a real rock god. I started wearing a vest with no shirt underneath, and I wear a top hat now. And I'm much cooler than I ever used to be. And it made my guitar sound, it took on the tone of Slash's guitar, which is incredible and powerful. And there's a ton of these different models that you can download from all the people that own these amps. And people have kind of like tweaked their amps to have different sounds and then use them as your own. And all this is on top of all the other effects and amps that are built into this amp that you can play around with on your own and control via your iPhone or iPad, like I said. So you'll be playing your guitar, and you can just be scrolling through different effects pedals, and you can change the order of the different effects to make them sound different. My mind was blown. This is one of the coolest pieces of technology I've touched, I'd say, in the last 2 or 3 years.
What about your, that mini Segway?
Oh, the mini Segway is definitely at the top too. I would put this in the same class as the mini Segway, something that is unlike anything that I've ever reviewed before. Extremely useful. I'm going to be sorry to send it back to them because I've kind of fallen in love with it. But they're really not that expensive as far as amps go. I think the GT200, which is the 200 watt version, is $650. It also comes with this foot pedal, which, by the way, it has a built-in looper, so you can play something up to 60 seconds of audio and then play it back over the amp and then play over it, and you can use that to practice, which is incredible. It's so fun to play like a chord progression and then try to solo over it. And it's also a great way to learn how to solo, and you don't need anyone else there to play guitar with you. You can just do it all on your own. I'm just gushing now. I really have fallen in love with it, and like I said, it comes in three models: the GT200, the GT100, which I think is $450, and then the GT40, which is a 40 watt version. And I think that amp is $250, but it doesn't come with a foot pedal. And there's a lot of other features that I'm forgetting to mention here because there's so much packed into this one amp. But if you're a guitar player, if you want to have an amp that is incredibly versatile, that will give you a ton of different sounds, and you don't want to spend a fortune on an amp. I mean, amps can cost $2,000-$3,000 for the really, really, you know, signature sound amps. This gets you all those amps, you know, in one easy-to-use device that you can control from your iPhone. And I think it's a really cool product. It's the Fender GT200 or the GT100 or the GT40. I'll link to all of them in the show notes. And that's what I'm reviewing right now. Lander, what do you got for us?
Huh. Well, mine's nowhere near as cool, I'm afraid. And in fact, it's very, you know, it's an unloved product category, and it's the good old iPhone case.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know what? People love when we talk about iPhone cases. I feel like we should talk about them more often.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got
Lander's like, good, because I got about 600 in my basement.
Well, we do. We could get sent dozens and dozens of them. You know, like a couple of boxes showed up this week with a bunch of new iPhone 8 and iPhone X cases, iPhone X cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be honest, they're all kind of, you know, they're sort of run-of-the-mill. Like, one case is much like any other case. There's occasionally a standout. And I've got one that I think is a standout, which is it's an OtterBox case, of all things. And, you know, like in the past, I've had OtterBox cases, giant, bulky, really huge, you know, unwieldy cases. This one's called the Strada Folio case. So it has a leather cover that folds over the front of the screen. and it's a polycarbonate, you know, plastic case. It's a little bit thick. It's a little bit bulky.
Well, it's an OtterBox.
But it definitely, you know, it's definitely protective for sure. And then it has leather on the back, and the leather goes all the way over to the front, so it protects your screen when it's closed. And it has a little slot in the front. You can put a credit card in there, or some money, or whatever else you like. It's really well made. It's really nice. It's really pleasing aesthetically. It has a magnet that holds it closed, and the leather part on the back and the case and the magnet, you know, together folds into like a little stand, which I find is actually the most useful feature. You know, so it folds into a little triangle.
Oh yeah, so you can kind of prop it up and you can watch.
Yeah, like, prop it up somewhere, watch a video.
That's cool.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a really, really good case. It's supposed to be about $50, but it's actually most places you can find it on sale, like on Amazon or Best Buy for $20, $25 or so.
Oh.
So, which is, you know, and that's actually a reasonable price for a case, you know, when they want $60, $70.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of good cases are $30, $40.
Right.
Definitely. Yeah.
So this is a good one. I recommend this.
Which phone is this for? Which phone are you using?
The iPhone 7.
Okay. Because do they have these available for iPhone 8 yet? I'm looking at their website.
It's the same. It fits the 8 as well.
Oh, right, because the iPhone 8 is virtually the same size, yeah.
Right.
Although I have heard that, I'm sure they tested this, but there are some cases that you have to get one made specifically for the iPhone 8 because, like, the really rigid cases especially, if they're not flexible, I mean, the iPhone 8, I think it's, like, what, like two pieces of paper thicker than the iPhone 7 and maybe, like, four pieces of paper wider. So you got to be careful. You can't just go out and get any iPhone 7 case and expect it to work on your iPhone 8.
Although most of the case makers say, you know, works with the iPhone 7 and the 8.
Really? So okay.
I think, yeah, well, there's a lot like that.
I would trust them before. Good point. Yeah. Just a word to the wise. Don't just go buy an iPhone 7 case expecting it's going to work. I mean, most of them do, but you want to be careful. Okay, that's the OtterBox. What's up?
Yeah, sorry. Should we do a case of the week? Maybe we should do that as a regular feature.
Yeah, we could do a case. Do you review that many cases?
Well, we could do, but you know, we definitely get more cases than we can talk about than I could write about. You know, like, but I could definitely talk about them. Yeah, we got a load. We got some stuff here from Notice. They make nice cases.
Oh, you Everglam, know what? They just reached out to me cases. And they were talking to me about their cases on Twitter actually, and I was like, well, these are actually really good looking cases.
Yeah. They're really nice. Really nicely made. Really
those are the leather ones, right?
Yeah. And they have magnets inside them, so you can clip them on places.
Yeah, we can start talking about cases more often. I don't know if to all of our listeners out there, if you want to start hearing about cases more often, let us know on Twitter, because people are going to be getting the new phones, and they're always interested in like what cases should I get with my phones. And actually, I've been reviewing a bunch of cases too, and I got a bunch of really minimalist cases that I really like because, you know, most cases are so gaudy and just wacky, and they have like weird stitching all over them, or they're giant hunks of plastic. Like for me, I'm always looking at, will this make my phone look better, or at least will it make it look neutral so that it's not going to be offensive to my eyes and put tears into Johnny Ive's eyes, right?
Yeah.
And I have a whole selection of cases that I've been testing out over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months that's meet all those criteria. A lot of really sleek, minimalist cases that make your phone look handsome and aren't going to make it look totally ugly. So maybe we should talk about cases more often. Okay. Well, I will include links to everything that we spoke about in the show notes in case you guys want to check any of this stuff out. But let's go ahead and wrap it up there. That's all the Cultcast we have for you guys this week. If you have any questions about any of the stories that we talked about today, or if you want to suggest a case for us to check out, or have any questions about the cases that we talked about, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at Airfun, but Buster's BST3R. Leander is L. Caney. This has been the Cultcast, the best 30-plus minute alpha conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the Cultcast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys Monday, October 2nd, this Monday, this upcoming Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific time for the live show, Monday.
It doesn't sound that bad.
No, you sound very enthusiastic about it.
Well, you know, yeah. People you like hearing your voice.
Oh, well, thank you. Hopefully our listeners feel the same way. I don't know what he's saying, but he's very enthusiastic, and I like that.
Yeah. Sounds so cool when he talks about Face ID.
Hey, Leander, so when are you going to start writing this Tim Cook book?
I don't know.
That's what you should call it, the Tim Cook book.
Yeah, I know. I was making jokes about that.
Are you going to get David to write half of it?
Yeah.
No, like three-fourths.
Maybe I can get him to do all of it, yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. It was like I said, it was because of that talk we had, and I wrote a quick note to my agent, you know, who I haven't talked to for like 3 years. And the next thing I know, he's emailed the publisher, and they said they were interested, so...
Oh, well, it's a great idea. I mean, yeah, has anyone done it? Too.
No. I think it'd be really good, because I think a lot of people don't appreciate, like, the most innovative thing about Apple is how they do everything at such a massive scale, and, like, how that whole machine, like, if you learn, you know, if you go research, like, the China shit and how everything's made and on time and everything, like, Tim Cook built it up, I think that'd actually be pretty fascinating.
Yeah, right. Do you want to write it, Buster?
No, I'm good.
You seem pretty passionate about it. How about you write it? Co-authored by Buster Heine and Erfan Elijah. With foreword by Erfan Elijah. Jacket picture is Erfan
Elijah.
It
should be foreword by Leander, written by David Buster.
Foreword. The Tim Cook book. Foreword by Leander Kinney, written by Lewis Wallace.
Yeah.